This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Music such as this is generally confined to Boston Symphony Hall or the New England Conservatory or the posh open-air theaters at Tanglewood. But the strains of Beethoven and Handel and Haydn will be heard this summer in open spaces and neighborhoods throughout the Boston area, thanks to the Landmarks Orchestra. The orchestra was founded 9 years ago by Charles Ansbacher. He's an accomplished peripatetic maestro who's conducted orchestras in Azerbaijan, Bosnia, Colombia, South Africa, Moldova, and Vietnam, among other far-flung nations. And with the Landmarks Orchestra, Ansbacher adds nearby impromptu stages in Dorchester, Jamaica Plain, Roxbury, and Charlestown to the list. But for Ansbacher, there's no difference between the hyperlocal and the global. His goal is the same, to bring classical music to places where people live and at prices they can afford. Charles Ansbacher joins me now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Maestro.
Thank you so much.
Well, Maestro, let me just begin by asking you, what made you decide to establish the Landmarks Orchestra?
Well, my wife was recruited at one of the local universities to teach at the Kennedy School, in fact, at Harvard. And I thought that was a great opportunity for her. And I said, why, sure, I'd love to move to Boston. At the time, we were living in Vienna, Austria. But it didn't become apparent to me until after being here 4 or 5 years that a city that was so well endowed with music and has such a rich musical life and tradition needed one more orchestra.
Why is it that it needed the Landmarks Orchestra?
Well,
what were you filling that need?
Most of the people growing up in Boston today don't have the privileges, certainly that I was brought up with, or many people were brought up with, that exposed them in one way or another to what generically we could call classical music or serious music. But not many opportunities, frankly, for youngsters or families to hear accessible classical music which could turn a new person into a classical music lover. And so it seemed to me that we could help preserve that Boston tradition if we went to a pattern of offering high-quality orchestral music in a setting that was inviting to families.
So instead of relying on people coming to Symphony Hall of their own accord, you brought the music to their neighborhoods.
Yes, at a time of year when they could enjoy a picnic, at a price that would not be a barrier, and with repertoire that would be inviting. All of our musicians, of course, we use the very best freelance musicians in the Boston area. So I found that we could put together this magnificent orchestra. There are wonderful historical settings here and architectural settings. And so the notion of this being a landmark orchestra goes to that. We try to find landmark locations which are fun to be in and educational, and those settings are enhanced by the music, and also the music enhances the location.
Mm-hmm. But some of those other landmark locations, as you were saying,
yes,
include neighborhoods which we may not think immediately of as sites for classical music,
exactly.
Roxbury, Dorchester, Jamaica Plain. So, Charles Ansbacher, let me just ask you, what has it been like to perform in these places, and how is it different, say, from performing in a typical classical music hall?
Well, it's often exciting because you don't know really what to expect. There is a bit of a trade-off acoustically. When you're playing in a fine, old, usually, building like Sanders Theater on the Harvard campus, the acoustics and the aesthetics are really magnificent. When you play out of doors on the Esplanade, you also have the accompaniment sometimes of jet airplanes.
Traffic on Storrow Drive.
Sometimes, or you hear the seagulls honking in the distance. So you are face-to-face with nature in our urban setting.
And how is it that audiences at these other locations have received the orchestra coming into their neighborhoods?
Yeah. Well, it frankly has depended often on our ability to come to the neighborhood first and do a certain explanation. We play in boys and girls clubs here and there in different areas. If we send somebody to that club beforehand and talk to the youngsters there about what we're doing, then the reception has greater understanding than if we just show up on a day and perform. And by the way, we do perform a lot for children, and we even commission pieces of music modeled after Peter and the Wolf. I like that format of there being a narrator telling mm-hmm. a story, which brings the children along, and then the music illustrates the story, just as Prokofiev did. But it usually has a Boston connection, like the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, but also national significance. I demand, to the extent that I have any authority in this area, to go to composers who I think write accessible music for young people today.
What does that mean, accessible for young people today?
Well, I feel it has to have something that a child, it could be a tune, it could be a rhythm, it could be a variety of instrumentations, it could be the story, but it has to have something that relates to children.
Charles Ansbacher, you're speaking about how you want to make music accessible to young people through its brightness and sometimes using things like narration. And we've actually got a sample of that here. Here's a little bit of the Landmarks Orchestra performing John Adams, The Voice Heard Around the World.
I would like to tell you of my parents' part in winning America's independence from Great Britain. My story comes from their letters to each other and through my eyes as a young boy.
And in it we hear
I might mention that we haven't yet, is that we commissioned this work. We commissioned the writing of it and the composing of the music, and the recording of it actually as well, and then playing it in Quincy, Mass for its premiere, where of course there is the Adams Estate, it's a national park, and we played it right there in Quincy.
And you had a young person do the narration, a young fellow named David Kenny, I believe.
Yes.
And he takes the role of John Quincy Adams, talking about his father, John Adams.
That's exactly right.
John Adams fought not on the battlefields, but by speaking up for America's independence in Congress and overseas. In 1775...
And Charles Ansbacher, why is it that instead of having the narrator take on the role of John Adams, you chose instead to have the narration be through the voice of young John Quincy Adams?
We try in every way to make what we do attractive and welcoming for our audience, and have some diversity in every respect, so that each year you don't know exactly what to expect, except that it'll be interesting. And we sometimes have famous narrators like Governor Dukakis has come, and this year our governor, Deval Patrick, will be reading a story and with music about Jackie Robinson. And there's something which I think a parent, or grandparent for that matter, could be very satisfied in giving to his or her children, because the children will learn something about music, and they will also learn something of importance about their community. And I may say, those kinds of things these days aren't easy to come by.
Charles Ansbacher, we here in Boston are the current beneficiaries of your work, but your work has also been globally recognized. President Bill Clinton once called you the unofficial ambassador of America's music, in part because of work you've done in other countries. For example, you conducted the Jerusalem Symphony with a Palestinian soloist back in December of 2005, so a very important cross-cultural exchange there, which you've repeated in various forms with other orchestras around the world. So how is it that you've been able to arrange concerts in areas of conflict like this?
Well, I've led a very privileged life in many ways, and one of those privileges was to live in Vienna, Austria for 4 years in the late 90s. And while there, I was able to get in and out of Sarajevo because I had a diplomatic passport because of my wife's position. And so I was able to work with an orchestra actually in a war zone and perform with them in and out of Sarajevo. And, you know, music really is, it's overused expression. People call it an international language. I don't agree with that entirely. It's an international emotional language. That's it is an easy way to communicate with people who speak Ukrainian or Chinese or, you know, Serbo-Croatian. I mean, all these people understand Beethoven and understand Brahms and understand Sousa to some degree or another.
So also you've done something similar in countries that are going through major transitions, maybe coming out of conflict. For example, why is it that you think that that's a particularly critical time to have classical music be a part of what the nation is experiencing?
Well, the people under these stressful circumstances are often every bit in as much need for the kind of satisfaction that one can get from going to a concert as people who are living in a comfortable time. And then I think it's also an experience that I can actually make a contribution in a way that I might not be able to if things were completely normal.
Well, if I may ask you to maybe share another little story with us, because I understand in 1995, you had actually had the opportunity to conduct the Sarajevo Philharmonic just after the signing of the Dayton Peace Accords.
That's true.
And I read here that you say, quote, "In my entire history with the Sarajevo Philharmonic, I have never seen musicians who have had such a difficult life and have had to overcome so much adversity. I shall never forget one concert where signs backstage read, 'No weapons on stage.'"
That's absolutely true. And it was interesting because I worked with the musicians in Sarajevo during the war and then as the war came to an end. And at first, when I went to Sarajevo after the Dayton Accords, I expected, you know, the people would be smiling and dancing in the street. And no, the people in Sarajevo were extraordinarily suspicious. They didn't think that the ceasefire would hold. They didn't think that peace was coming. And it took them actually, I would say, years to kind of accept the fact that they had a chance at normal life, because the war had been so difficult, and especially on those in Sarajevo.
Well, I imagine, I mean, the city was destroyed in the war, much of it. It was brutal and long, but to have this flowering of beautiful music through your conducting of the Philharmonic must have given them some relief, at least. Well, let's listen to a little bit more of music that you have conducted, and this is with the Moscow Symphony Orchestra, and I believe it is Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, the second movement. So that is the Allegretto, the second movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, a live performance conducted by Charles Ansbacher and performed by the Moscow Symphony Orchestra. So Charles Ansbacher, you also perform a series, and quite frequently, especially over the summers in Boston, every Wednesday night at the Hat Shell. So tell us a little bit about that.
We play at this acoustically very good facility, the Hat Shell, on Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m., every Wednesday evening in the summer from July 14th through September 1st. And these are the concerts that are free and open to the public, and people should plan on coming, bringing a blanket, their children, and it really is a place to be comfortable. And I enjoy it because turns out I have a lot of assistant conductors in the audience. Some of them are 5 and 6 year old. And we have dancers accompanying us too, often young ones, now 5 and 6. So we have it's quite a happening.
Well, Charles Ansbacher, conductor of Boston's Landmarks Orchestra, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
A link to the Landmarks Orchestra summer season schedule is on our website, wbur.org/Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.